He didn't know my fierce need to be unbridled, the ache for my feminine soul. I yearned for his support. I wished for a marriage where we could walk paths that allowed for the unconditional sharing of soul. Without it, marriage becomes very lonely. Writing poignantly about the strain on her marriage that came from following her feminine journey, Jungian analyst Jean Shinoda Bolen wrote, "The need to share what we experience, to be listened to have what is going on inside us matter to the person we are married to engage in a two-way dialogue, is the cry of one soul yearning to meet another. It was my cry, but I couldn't seem to make it heard, and to be honest, I couldn't hear his cry very well either." In the weeks that followed, I canceled most of my social engagements, worked to clear off my desk, and stayed at home. I poured uncensored words into my journal, took walks in the cold, shed tears from old, forgotten reservoirs. I felt like I was dissolving, a dandelion going to seed. I didn't have guidelines for what I was doing. I didn't really know if what I was attempting was possible. Was there really another story to be lived beside the one I was living? If so, no one had ever told it to me. I imagined there was another way of being a woman, but what was it? At times, near panic swept over me. "What am I doing? What am I doing?" I would ask. "What will become of my marriage? My religion? Are there other images of the divine that do not obliterate the feminine? Is there another container to hold my spiritual journey? If so, what is it?" I had fond thoughts about regressing to the old way. I would stare at women in the grocery store, women who drove their carts about the aisles with seeming content, and I would think, "I want to be like that again." I wished for security, knowing it could not be had. In February, I boarded an airplane for California. Finding the Circle of Trees. It was night. I was sitting in an aisle seat on the plane. A beam of overhead light, thin and yellow as a pencil, drifted down to dilute the gathering dark. I turned off the light and tried to sleep, but ended up nursing a sense of loss that seemed heavier than ever. I ran down the list. I was losing my marriage, at least the marriage we'd had in the past. My spiritual life was crumbling, at least the way it had existed before. My career of inspirational writing might even follow. I was also losing my identity, the roles of daughterhood that had sustained me, and along with that, my way of receiving validation in the world. I was losing the values from my childhood, my orientation to life. I was on this plane flying through the darkness, and it was not lost on me that spiritually, I was also flying blind. I had no idea where I was headed. Years after this plane ride, I traveled to Crete with 14 other women, all of them on feminist spiritual journeys. While there, we descended into a cave called Skoteno, where thousands of years earlier women and men had come to worship the goddess as Skoteni, goddess of the dark. We moved by candlelight, climbing down four levels, the air growing dark and cold, until finally we came to the cave floor. We sat, holding beeswax candles. On the count of three, we blew them out. No one spoke, though I could hear our breathing loud as wind. We stayed that way 3, 4, 5 minutes, in the blackest black I've ever known. I began to lose my boundaries, even the sense of my own skin. I was floating in darkness. And from the darkness, the one image that returned to me was that plane ride years earlier, flying to California. I had the same sense in the cave that I had on the plane, of floating in darkness, having no markers by which to define my world, no path, no container, no place to be. In the cave, one of the women began to sing Skoteni. Others joined in, until an aria of women's voices sifted through the blackness, calling on the goddess of the dark. Finally, someone struck a match, lit her candle, and offered her flame to the woman beside her. The light moved woman to woman around the cave, each woman's face flickering momentarily behind the flame. Watching the light grow, thinking back to the plane ride, I realized that even back then, something inside me was calling on the goddess of the dark, even though I didn't know her name. And I thought, too, how important it was at times like that to receive light from other women, to receive their permission to be where we are. But on the flight to California, I had no idea where to find light, and really, it was too soon. Descent is not about finding light, but about going into the darkness and befriending it. If we remain there long enough, it takes on its own luminosity. It will reveal everything to us. A flight attendant swished along the aisle, paused, offered me a blanket. I tucked it around me, sliding over to the empty seat beside the window and staring through the small oval. The world outside was shiny black, glazed with the lights of the night. The moon hovered behind the wing. It was a pale crescent no bigger than my fingernail. I wondered if it was waxing or waning. I wondered what would happen when I got to California. Over the loudspeaker, the captain said we would soon start our descent. "Ha!" I almost said out loud. Restless, I raised the seat, turned on the light again, reached for a magazine in the seat pocket. I flipped the pages. Suddenly, my hands rested on a picture. I was looking at a circle of trees in the woods. I cannot tell you now whether it was an aerial photograph or an artist's rendering. I only remember the circle of trees. It was a near-perfect circle of oaks and evergreens in the middle of a forest. The sun was piercing its way through the limbs, striking the center, illuminating a golden ellipse of space, still, hidden, contained. Once I'd read about a child who opened her favorite picture book on the floor and stepped onto the page, trying to get inside the world she loved. I felt like that now. I wanted to disappear into the magazine, into the circle of trees. The image seized me, as if it were some realm I had lost and suddenly found again. I began to imagine the circle as a place where once, perhaps long ago, women had gathered, danced, dreamed, healed, grown wise and powerful together. A place where women were honored, loved, and supported, where they were invited, even encouraged, to become different sorts of women. The circle of trees touched me like a memory and a promise both. Later I came to realize that the circle of trees was for me an inner feminine sanctum of containment, support, and new life, the space of female soul that I needed to find and from which I needed to live. A woman finds her way to this circle of trees in order to become fully woman, fully herself. But how do you find it, I wondered. Did I begin by creating a container, inner and outer circles of trees, that could hold and nurture me as I began the process of reconnecting to my feminine soul? I closed my eyes. Yes, I thought. Yes. Today, more than ever, I'm aware how much a woman needs a container like that. She needs an embracing, open-armed space where she can dissolve, go to seed, and regerminate. A place to be still and tend new roots. She needs a place away from every man-made thing where she can cry, even shout if she wants. In a place like that, she can begin to heal what is wounded, recover what is lost. She can remember herself. I ran my finger around the rim of the circle on the page and prayed my first prayer to a divine feminine presence. I said, "Mother God, I have nothing to hold me, no place to be, inside or out. I need to find a container of support, a space where my journey can unfold." When I landed, I had a nebulous course of direction, a kind of bearing to live toward. What I did not know was that one day, not so far away, I would also find the circle of trees in the literal world. A solitude of descent. After my speaking engagement, I settled into a small bed and breakfast in San Francisco for several days of solitude. I had hoped to stay at Mercy Center in Burlingame, a retreat house south of San Francisco that I'd wanted to visit for a long time, but at the last minute I couldn't arrange it. Not knowing of another, I decided on the inn because I'd been there before and remembered the rooms were cozy, that it had a fireplace downstairs with an overstuffed chair where a person could sit unperturbed and look out over Washington Square. Besides, I told myself, the place wasn't so important. It was self-containment that mattered. Most of the time I spent in my room. The first day I was aware of noise on the street, but gradually it seemed to recede. I whiled away an hour following the pattern sunlight made on the carpet. I felt myself sinking into solitude. My sense of isolation was almost overpowering. I wished 10, 20, 30 times that I hadn't come, but I made no attempt to leave. In the end, the force in me to make the descent was stronger than the desire to flee it. I had a book with me called Woman Christ, and I read passages from it now and then. One of them was this. Whether we have taken the path of the fathers, educating ourselves in their institutions, learning their language, seeking their goals, energizing ourselves with success in their endeavors, or supported the fathers in their path, creating their homes, birthing and rearing their children, encouraging their dreams, healing their wounds, we have most often made beauty out of our work. We rejoice in our careers and in our children. We are proud of our spouses' achievements and our belief that helped make those achievements happen. Then one day, everything is dry. Dust, crumbled and blowing away on a stale wind. Being vice president of the company no longer matters. Being a competent wife feels meaningless. The time has come not to reclaim what has been lost, but to descend. To find the ground of our own being, we must descend. I closed the book. Wrapped in aloneness, with permission to feel my experience, I was suddenly overcome with an acute sense of loss. Loss of what had been. Loss of identity. My experience was teaching me the truth of Nell Morton's words, that there is an awful abyss that occurs after the shattering and before the new reality appears. I also thought about Adrienne Rich's poem Diving into the Wreck, in which she writes of the experience of unmeaning, which a woman encounters when she dives into the wreck of patriarchal culture, and seeing what it is, begins at last to swim beyond it on her own. For a time we feel stripped of ourselves, which is only natural, since so much of our meaning has come from our identity in patriarchy. Patriarchy has created us in its image, writes Starhawk, writer, teacher, and activist. Once we see that image, however, it no longer possesses us unaware. We can reshape it, create something new. But first, before the reshaping, the recreation, there is the blank, stunned space of feeling stripped and peeled. We are not who we used to be, and not who we will become. We are in the terrain of unmeaning, and we are alone in it. I do not think in words so much as in pictures, and the image that often came to me as I was cloistered away in that small inn was a windsock, hanging still and empty on some lonely stretch of land. I could see myself as the windsock, the prevailing wind, the identity and meaning that had filled me like a gale-blown force, had died away. Unable now to point the direction, I felt emptied of my meaning, unable to know the shape of myself. I wept at the possibility of losing my marriage, my career, at the vulnerability of shedding my daughterhood, the loss of religious alignment. My perception of the divine had proved rigid, inadequate. Western Christian patriarchal boxes could not hold it. The divine was more of an unmapped mystery than I'd fathomed. Yet as expansive as that might sound, I did not lose the accustomed symbols of my religion without grief. Also, the thought of forfeiting my dependence on masculine validation and giving up salvation through male saviors left me feeling alone and denuded, thrown back completely on myself. I'd struggled to come to terms with my feminine woundedness. I was aware of my lost feminine standpoint and the severed connection to my feminine soul. I sensed how my exclusive identification with a Father in heaven had encouraged my estrangement from my female self, from earth, nature, mother, and the wisdom and validation of these things. Patriarchy had created a world where spirit is split from body, humans from nature, and natural from divine, and I could feel those splits in myself. I mourned those gaping holes. During those isolated days, I sometimes stood before the mirror, inwardly saying the first of many goodbyes to the woman I had been. In crossing the unexplored gorge, an act that cannot be accomplished in several days, to be sure, but can take months and years, our task is to surrender to the experience and make the descent consciously, with intention and awareness. We will need to let the old forms break, giving up our identity as spiritual daughters of patriarchy and learning to say goodbye. In the trek across the gorge, we often scan about for shortcuts. During that period, I often wished some wise woman who'd been there before me would appear and tell me how to zip through it. If she had, though, she probably would have admonished me to give up seeking a shortcut and just be where I was. There is deep wisdom in giving up the fight to make it go away. When we instead come home to our path, we come home to what is. You are where you are. So be there. Stop trying to protect yourself from the harshness of right now, fleeing into a long fabrication about how it's going to be one day. That's a way of avoiding the here and now truth of our lives. Women who want to be grown-up women will have to come to a blatant self-acceptance. I think the wise woman, if she had appeared, would have said, "Don't try to leap over yourself. Just accept what is and be with it. Really be with it. Because when you do that, you are being in the moment, in the truth. You are being present as you live your life. In the end, is there anything else?" In an old Sumerian myth, the goddess Inanna, making a descent to the underworld, moves through seven gates. At each gate, she must strip a piece of her clothing away until at last she is naked, arriving without any of her former trappings. At the depth of her descent, she is turned into a piece of meat and hung on a meat hook for several days before being resurrected as a woman. I've often wondered if that's where we get the idea of wanting to be let off the hook. Those days at the inn were my meat hook, one of many, and a lot of the time I wanted someone to come and get me off it. But I also began in bits and pieces to be present while I lived my life, to stay on the hook despite the sense of loss and unmeaning I felt. Holding on to the circle of trees helped me stay there. Even when my sense of losing everything, of disappearing into nothing, was at its most vivid, the image of the circle of trees appeared and reappeared. Once when I fell asleep in the middle of the afternoon, I dreamed of it. On waking, I drew the first of many circles of trees in my journal, strengthening the hope that I could create a sacred and vital space in which to be free as a woman and unfold my feminine journey. My last morning at the inn, I rose early and went downstairs for breakfast. I gazed through the window across the square, where dozens and dozens of Chinese Americans moved in slow motion under the trees. They were doing Tai Chi, a form of exercise as exquisite as ballet. Compelled, I walked across the street and sat beneath a tree to watch. Jean Shinoda Bolen has written that when we're at significant junctures of transition, outer events and meetings are often filled with messages that should be heeded. That was the case as I fixed my eyes on a lone Chinese woman among a sea of men. A striking elderly woman, she had deeply wrinkled skin and long graying hair that had slipped partially from its coil. The group was copying the movements of a leader out front, following them with rigid exactness. But with bold improvisations all her own, the old woman ignored the rest and moved spontaneously to a soundless music inside herself. Wildly out of sync, she danced her own dance and no one else's. "This woman has heard the flute," I thought, and for the first time during that interval of pain, I smiled. I watched until the class had finished and she had gone. What was it about her? I realized suddenly that she reminded me of the old woman in my dreams, the one who'd come with a snake-twined walking stick, bidding me to follow my own feminine path instead of a male-defined way. I remained sitting there a long while. For days, my thoughts and feelings had been like shards of glass flying in all directions, but now they came together, forming something solid and singular, an unimpeachable knowing. What I was experiencing was okay. I was okay feeling it, and moving to the soundless music inside, even when that music became a symphony of pain, was necessary and beautiful. An energy rose in me from down under, the kind of energy that sends flowers and grass through cracks in the driveway. I told myself this: whatever time it takes for the old patterns to die and the birth of a new feminine consciousness, I would allow it. I would not, could not, forfeit my journey for my marriage, or for the sake of religious acceptance, or success as a Christian writer. I would keep moving in my own way to the strains of feminine music that sifted up inside me, not just moving, but embracing the dance. I knew that by being here in my solitary descent, I had already begun to create a circle of trees, and that I would go on creating it. My descent didn't abruptly end here, though I found the sense of loss and fear lessening for a while. Descent would continue for many months as I traveled new places in the gorge. It is worth noting that rarely is any awareness or process on this journey a one-time event. We seem to return to it over and over, each time integrating it a bit more fully, owning it a little more deeply. I may be laying out the general contours of the feminine spiritual process, but there are no neat, clear-cut lines where one phase precisely ends and the next begins. Each woman has her own timing and her own way. The passages she takes will overlap and spiral around, only to be experienced again. Opening to the Feminine Divine. The afternoon after encountering the Chinese woman, I made my way to Mercy Center in Burlingame for a quick visit before returning home. As I came into the entryway, a shadowed, still room deserted of people, I found myself gazing at a large picture, one I'd never seen before. It was a replica of Leonardo da Vinci's cartoon of Saint Anne. I felt a quickening sensation in my body, a soft current that spread from my belly up through my breasts and down my arms. Jean Shinoda Bolen calls the sensation a sensory intuition or tuning fork phenomenon. It may occur when something deep inside us responds with an instinctual awareness to sacred moments and events. Feminine knowing often registers in the body even before the mind. The picture portrayed a great, flashing-eyed woman whose immense lap held both Mary and Christ. I felt I was looking at an image of the divine feminine, the great mother, for the woman in the picture seemed to birth, contain, and encompass everything, even the male savior. Standing there, I felt a deep, magnetic awareness of her. When we truly grasp for the first time that the symbol of woman can be a vessel of the sacred, that it too can be an image of the divine, our lives will begin to pivot. Today, a lot of women are seeking feminine imagery of the divine. More women than we can imagine have embarked on the quest, enough women to set in motion a whole shift in our religious paradigm. I've met countless numbers of these women, married, divorced, and single, some of them Christian theologians and ministers, but also insurance agents, real estate agents, nurses, students, psychologists, travel agents, school teachers, mothers who stay home and work, artists, writers, accountants, to only name a few, all of whom are talking passionately about the return of Mother God or Sophia or Goddess. I've been struck by how these women's lives are anchored in the real world, how bright and unique, yet ordinary they are. The divine feminine is returning to collective consciousness, all right. She's coming, and it will happen whether we're ready or not. That day at Mercy Center, I studied the picture a long time. The lap dominated the image. It seemed to me like a sacred space, another circle of trees, a place of loving containment and feminine embrace where a woman could be reborn. I carried that image with me on the plane home. The whole way I had that feeling you get inside when you stop swimming salmon backward against yourself and yield to your own internal flow. But I knew it didn't necessarily mean everything around me would coincide. I kept thinking of my husband. Sandy met me at the airport and held me tightly for a very long time. Then on the 40-minute drive home, He asked about my trip. I did not hold back. I told him how I'd felt at the inn, about the Chinese woman, the painting at Mercy Center. The car filled with silence, but I could see in his face that he was struggling to get something out.
While you were gone, I was thinking, he said. I realized I've been so invested in maintaining everything exactly as it is, I couldn't allow your experience.
My eyes widened. He didn't say much else, and I knew that he didn't really understand what I was doing and maybe would never be at peace with this journey of mine. And although neither of us knew whether things would work out in the end, because there are never guarantees, I knew that right now he wanted to try, and for me, it was enough. Sometimes you get very unexpected gifts. I think of the dictum that when one person in a relationship starts to become conscious, the other is compelled to become conscious too. Awakening precipitates awakening, and sometimes a woman's dogged groping for enlightenment and wholeness will ignite the process in her mate, or vice versa. But it's not always so. There has to be enough wick present, enough willingness, openness, pliability, and grace to receive the flame. Women should not be naive. Wicks, wind, and fire are uncertain business. Sometimes rigidity and resistance are too encrusted, and the relationship cannot survive the changes going on in a woman. No matter the patience, love, and consciousness brought to bear, it may happen that the relationship simply cannot break through to a new place. I've met women who in such circumstances have stayed, and others who've left. Such choices are achingly difficult, and I've learned to respect whatever a woman feels she must do. Sandy's transformation began with that tiny pivot of consciousness he described that day in the car. Over the next few years, I watched a slow but dramatic evolution unfold in him. I watched with stupefaction and awe. I will not say much about it because it is his story, not mine, to tell. But as time went by, he too was thrust into soul-searching. He began to look at the roots from which his own life sprang. He came to see, and I did too, that patriarchy wounds men also, that men have their own journeys to make in order to heal and differentiate themselves from it. He began a spiritual and psychological journey of his own. He began to open up in new ways, to read new books, to ask new questions, to change and grow. After a lot of struggle, he came to support an egalitarian and feminist vision, not in name only, but in the way he lived and related, and he came to support me. Feminist writer Naomi Wolf sums up what is happening as men make this choice. The world of men is dividing into egalitarians and patriarchalists, those men who are trying to learn the language and customs of the newly emerging world, and those who are determined to keep that new order from taking root. The former group welcomes these changes, seeing that though they are painful in the short term, over the long term they provide the only route to intimacy and peace. But the latter group sees only loss. The patriarchalists' worldview, shared by women as well as men, is battling the emerging egalitarian worldview, which is also shared by people of both sexes. After nearly 15 years as a teacher and chaplain on a college campus, my husband returned to school and obtained his credentials as a licensed psychotherapist. Today, in a private counseling practice, he has a particular sensitivity to helping couples face the changes that are inevitable in the life of souls and relationships. That's how it turned out in the end. But in the first months after my return from California, we experienced doubt and tension. I woke every day to uncertainty about my marriage. We found ourselves standing at the site of a leveled relationship, one we ourselves had purposely collapsed from top to bottom, like those old buildings that explosive experts bring down in a cloud of dust and applause in order to make way for new construction. A marriage or any relationship between partners is meant to be created and then recreated. It is an edifice a couple builds until the day the edifice can no longer hold them and they must bring it down and start again from scratch, and without any of the old assumptions. It's exactly like Carolyn Heilbrunn says,
All marriages are remarriages. Psychologist Jean Baker Miller, who has done extensive research on women's development, has written about a growth-fostering relationship as having five characteristics. She says that in the relationship, 1, each person feels a greater sense of zest, vitality, energy. 2, each person feels more able to act and does act. 3, each person has a more accurate picture of herself or himself and the other person. 4, each person feels a greater sense of worth. 5, each person feels more connected to the other person and a greater motivation for connections with other people beyond those in the specific relationship. Though it was slow, hazardous, and often exasperating work, Sandy and I worked to undo the old marriage and create a new one stripped of the old dependencies and patriarchal setup, a growth-inducing relationship that offered each of us freedom to choose and be, that not only allowed for, but enhanced the soul in each of us. A ritual of intention. The April following my trip to California, I went on an overnight speaking trip and invited my friend Betty to come along. I was eager for time to talk. We spent a lot of the trip sharing stories and mulling over the growing feminist consciousness we were both experiencing, wondering how to create a spiritual path that would allow for it. As we were driving home, the top down on Betty's convertible and the two of us full of excitement about our discussions, we approached a lake, and she suddenly pulled the car off the road. The sun was about to set, and a sheet of burned light stretched across its surface. "We've talked for 2 days. It's time to do something about all this," she said. We decided we would create an impromptu ritual, right there, on the spot. 2 long-stemmed red roses lay on the seat between us, a gift from someone who'd come to hear me speak. And in Betty's purse we found a vial of perfume. They were the only ritual objects we could come up with. We carried them down a slope of trees to the edge of the lake. Standing there in our heels and dress-up clothes, without any particular idea about how it would unfold, we spoke of our need and desire to know and relate to a power of being that was feminine in essence, to graft back what had been excised and absent from our spiritual lives. We asked the feminine divine to welcome us as her own, to guide us, to bless our launching. We sprinkled the perfume on the water and tossed the roses onto the lake. We did this in silence, then watched the roses float across the water, moving farther than we would have imagined. In that act, we ritualized our intention to cast ourselves upon a new life, to cross to a new shore. As we returned to the car and drove on, I felt almost buoyant. I remember thinking that I would ever after mark that event, along with the one at Mercy Center, as the advent of her into my life. It was my first creation of ritual, and now, after so many other creations, I still cannot understand how they are able to alter my consciousness in such remarkable ways. I don't really try. I am glad to let certain mysteries be mysteries. I simply know that rituals performed consciously can be powerful catalysts of change. They can be moments of integration, making something suddenly clear, making us stronger inside, opening up unknown places within us, and imbuing new meaning. Crossing the threshold. A couple weeks later, Betty and I were driving together once again, this time through the low country of South Carolina, when we happened upon a sign that said Springbank Retreat Center. I was on my way to another speaking engagement, but had some extra time, so we turned off the main road and wound back into solitary woodlands, a land of gnarled oaks draped with floating moss. We stopped before a 2-story white columned house. I looked at Betty. She looked at me. Our eyes said, "What have we found?" A Catholic sister met us at the door, introduced herself as Kathleen, and happily showed us around. Once a plantation during the Civil War, the place was now a center for spiritual retreat run by a small group of sisters. They had created an open, safe space that embraced the creation spirituality of theologian Matthew Fox
and honored feminine and Native American spiritualities, ecology, and contemplation. Already I had the inscrutable sense that something purposeful had guided us here. Then Kathleen led us into the chapel. There, in a soulful moment, I came face to face with the identical picture I'd encountered in California, the cartoon of Saint Anne. I gazed at it with the same electric hum running through my body that I'd felt before, the same magnetic pull. I was filled with awe at happening upon a synchronicity such as this. Synchronicities, those times when an outer event resonates mysteriously and powerfully with what's happening inside, are more numerous during great shifts and upheavals. If we pay attention, if we approach them as symbolic and revelatory, they will often illumine a way for us. Coming upon the cartoon of Saint Anne a second time suggested many things to me, not the least of which was that this place would become deeply significant to me. Perhaps here I would begin to find my way into the space of the Great Lap. And so it happened. 3 months later, in July, Betty and I returned to Springbank for a weekend stay. On Saturday morning, despite a muggy heat, we followed a trail through Springbank's 58 acres of woods. After 20 minutes or so, we entered a clearing. It did not take but a second to realize that we were standing in a circle of trees. Another synchronicity, but one that startled me far more than the picture. Here was the symbolic circle I'd happened upon on the airplane, the circle I'd sketched, imagined, dreamed about, and looked to as a guiding image of the feminine ground. The circle was formed by pine, dogwood, magnolia, small oaks, and scrubs, the clearing inside 30 or so yards in diameter, with a small fire pit dug in the center. I walked around the circle, touching the tree trunks as the circle and the Great Lap became one and the same. Far from churches, prayer books, sermons, and theological propositions, I felt intimately embraced by nature. The circle touched Betty in an equally strong way, and we sat within it, on the ground. There were only two seeming blemishes in the entire clearing, two small unsightly stumps. "They need to go," we agreed, and before we had really thought about it, we were on our way back for tools. Much of the afternoon we spent digging up the stumps. It turned out to be harder than we had anticipated. The roots went deep. As I worked, I became aware of anger, the anger at patriarchy, that wants to come like a purifying blaze. I felt it with every swing of the axe and jab of the shovel. It wasn't until we'd finally wrestled the stumps out of the ground, refilled the holes, and sat down to rest that we fully realized the symbolism of what we'd done. We'd ritualized digging up the dead stunted tree, the old way, the old model, the patriarchal stump. We were getting rid of it, releasing anger, transforming it into something creative. We were reclaiming the feminine ground. The space began to feel like ours somehow. We looked around, glad to be rid of the stumps, but something seemed to be missing. We found a large white stone, rolled it through the woods, and placed it at one edge of the circle. We dug up soft emerald moss and planted it around the stone. Then we stood back and looked at it. We had built an altar. Dancing by Night. That night we entered the woods again, following the trail by flashlight. At night, the woods was a ceremony of sounds. Crickets, tree frogs, and night birds all joined in a chorus of song, outrageously loud. I had never done anything like this in my life, and I kept thinking how strange it would appear, two grown and proper women picking their way through the woods at night in search of what? But at the same time, I was compelled, almost as if some ancient homing instinct inside had been activated and was pulling me along. We found the circle of trees easily enough, having marked the trail earlier that afternoon. After building a fire, we sat and watched the light leap around the trees. I looked up at the ring of sky, at the moon full and bulging, and I felt an exuberant, cage-rattling energy rise inside, something feminine, primal, free. Like the women on the beach 2 years earlier,
We began to dance. I moved slowly around the circle of trees, around the fire, past the altar of stone and moss, then faster until my bare feet were pounding the ground. Thump, thump, thump. The sound landed in the silence with an untamed energy that was new to me, but also recognizable and right, like feet staking out their ground, announcing their existence, stomping out of exile and coming home. Later, I would be surprised at our lack of inhibition, but then it seemed the most natural, the most necessary thing in the world, this dancing. We didn't stop to analyze what we were doing, and when an owl lifted from a low branch, beating her wings over our heads, it seemed to us like some sort of blessing. We danced, 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 while the fire sank to embers, until we were nearly breathless, and I had rung open all the cages inside and set myself free. Is there a feeling more gleeful than opening a cage and setting something captured free? I was reminded of the time I stayed at a bed and breakfast owned by a retired couple. One morning, as I strolled in the backyard gardens, I saw the man checking wire cages the size of shoeboxes, which were tucked discreetly among the shrubs. Most of them, I noticed, were filled with squirrels. I watched, horrified, as he carried the cages to the backyard pool, lowered them one by one into the water, and left them there until the squirrels' frantic little bodies stopped scrambling and they drowned. Then he disposed of the bodies and reset the traps. That evening, when the man had left to go to church, that's right, church, I went all about the yard throwing open the cages and feeling the most delicious sense of glee as the squirrels shot out and up the trees, making riotous leaps through the branches. I believe most women have inside us one of those figures who goes around laying discreet traps, trying to cage, restrict, and drown the spirited natural parts of us, the parts that go leaping through life. And it is a good thing, a holy thing even, to circle around by stealth if necessary, and set them free again. That night in the woods, I felt a little like those squirrels must have felt as they reveled among the trees with their freedom. Something lost and caged was returning to me, the unrestrained and essential woman I'd lost by becoming a daughter of patriarchy. I realized this free and dancing woman was the one I'd been asked to birth that day at the monastery when I sat on the nest of yellow leaves. Now here she was, emerging. A mist of rain began, but we danced on. Finally, we plopped down laughing, satiated, prodding the fire, which was now sodden. I could never remember feeling so vibrant and alive. That night, in my dreams, I was once again back in the circle of trees. Two red snakes crawled to my feet. I wanted to run at first, but I stood still, sensing they had a beneficent, sacred quality. They stared into my eyes and almost seemed to smile. I felt my heart grow warm beneath my breast, and reaching down, I picked them up, one in each hand, and lifted them over my head. When I woke, my thought was that I was finally being reunited with the snake in myself, that lost and defiled symbol of feminine instinct. Weeks later, however, I would come upon an even deeper layer of meaning in the dream. Before leaving Springbank, Betty and I walked back to the circle in the woods. Standing there in the clear light of morning, I knew I'd crossed a threshold. A woman's initiation includes many moments of crossing a threshold. This threshold is the bridge to our feminine soul, and crossing over is the beginning of becoming. By crossing it, we are moving into a new landscape of feminine consciousness, one in which we feel regenerated or expanded as women. There are many ways to cross the threshold. One woman I know made a pilgrimage to the ruins of a pre-patriarchal culture. Another met with a group of women who came together and told the truth about their lives as women. One woman told me she crossed a threshold when another woman embraced her as she wept. It was, she explained to me, like I was being held by Mother Goddess herself. I have not been the same since. And that is really the telling thing. When a woman crosses a threshold, she knows that something inside her has shifted, if only slightly. She knows that she is on a different trajectory. A guiding feminine myth. My experiences over the year, the trip to California, moments of dissent, loss, grief, fear, the struggle to blend marriage and journey, the magnetic pull to the divine feminine, crossing the threshold in the woods, all left me with a strong desire to find a space where my journey could unfold in the midst of a wise guiding presence. In September, I crossed another threshold when I entered Jungian analysis with a woman analyst. It ushered me into another circle of trees. I had just started analysis when a compelling cache of images turned up in my dreams. Large spiraling labyrinths and a bare-breasted woman with snakes wound up her arms. Being in analysis is occasionally like sleuth work. Not only did I spend time amplifying the personal meaning of dream images, but I also sometimes ended up in libraries researching their deeper, more archetypal meanings. One day at a university library, while researching labyrinths, I found myself at a little desk in the stacks, surrounded by books on Minoan Crete. Until then, I'd known practically nothing about Minoan Crete. That day, I discovered it was a highly evolved culture that existed in Greece up until around 1450 BCE, a culture in which the supreme deity was female and women and feminine values enjoyed high cultural valuing. Scholar Rhianne Eisler suggests Minoan Crete was the last surviving example of a pre-patriarchal society. The labyrinth was a dominant symbol of Minoan culture, appearing repeatedly and centrally in its art, architecture, stories, and religion. The word labyrinth even originated in that culture. I also discovered a picture of two ancient statues of the bare-breasted, flounced-skirted Minoan goddess, which now reside in the Heraklion Museum in Crete. One statue pictures her holding a red snake in each hand, lifting them over her head. The other pictures her with a snake wound up each arm. I sat a long while marveling, remembering my dreams of labyrinths, the dream of the woman with the snakes wound up her arms, but especially the dream I'd had after dancing in the circle of trees, picking up the two red snakes and lifting them over my head. How had these images gotten into my dreams? My question was answered in Jungian analysis. As Jung showed, our dreams sometimes spring from the collective unconscious, the place that holds collective human history. The images in my dreams were coming from a place inside me that predated patriarchy. With time, I would see that the dreams were suggesting that I needed to dig beneath the patriarchal layers within myself and find an earlier ground, a realm of feminine valuing. A few days after visiting the library, I listened to an audio tape someone had given me that related several Greek myths. One was the myth of Ariadne, who, the storyteller said, was a princess from Minoan Crete. I'd come upon a myth, a sacred narrative set in the Minoan culture. I once heard author Gertrude Nelson repeat the definition of a myth that her young son had come up with. He said, "A myth is something that is true on the inside, but not true on the outside." Like a dream, a myth can paint a true picture of a person's psyche. Myths, however, also reveal a lot about the contents and dynamics of the group mind. As I began to study the myth of Ariadne, I felt I was discovering a drama that gave symbolic expression to the process going on inside of me and of women in general. But when we use a myth this way, we need to hear author Charlene Spretnak's caution to delineate between those myths that were created within patriarchy and those that predate it. Myths born in patriarchy offer a limited source of data on women. What they usually tell is how women react under patriarchy. The myth of Ariadne that exists today was created within patriarchy during the 7th century BCE, many hundreds of years after the Minoan culture had disintegrated. As such, it reflects how women respond within patriarchy. From my perspective, the story tells how women revolt against patriarchy, and it illumines a process we go through as we make our exit from it. But to fully grasp the significance of this later story, we need to understand the story's earlier layers. An earlier myth of Ariadne
which predated patriarchy, no doubt flourished during the time of the Minoan culture, we no longer have direct access to this layer of the myth, but we can surmise what the earlier Ariadne looked like. For instance, the original Ariadne was not a mortal princess, as in the later story, but the goddess herself. The name Ariadne means most holy, and she was no doubt revered as the supreme power, the great mother whose totem companion was the snake. She was also known as the Lady of the Labyrinth. As the great mother, Ariadne was the source of all that is, and her womb was envisioned as a labyrinth that humans threaded on their journey through life, death, and rebirth. Her role was that of sacred guide, the one who aided persons through the dark, difficult passages. The Ariadne of the later story is the figure that emerged after patriarchal Greece got through with her. She was demoted, downsized from goddess to a daughter princess in her father's kingdom. She went from Ariadne, Holy One, to Ariadne, Daddy's Princess. But even this discrepancy between the two myths has much to teach us, for the same sort of thing has happened to and within women. We have gone through our own demotion in power and status, stripped of the image of the divine as feminine in our own souls. Growing up in patriarchy, many of us went from embodying feminine wholeness to being good princesses of the cultural father. My work with the myth, which would continue for a long time, focused mostly on the later story set in patriarchy. I have come to interpret it as a woman's struggle to win her freedom from patriarchy, though I also draw on ideas from the earlier version. As I worked with the myth through that long winter, it gradually became a lens through which I viewed my experience, a containing story that not only elaborated and clarified my journey, but also showed me the possibilities in it. Ariadne and the Old King. We know from the myth that Ariadne was a princess in her father's kingdom. That doesn't seem like a lot of information, but symbolically it tells us all we need to know. It tells us that psychologically and spiritually, Ariadne was a good daughter of patriarchy, a little princess. In myths, the old king usually symbolizes the old patriarchal consciousness. As a daughter of the old king, Ariadne is presented as being identified with her roles in patriarchy, as trying to be what it wants and needs her to be. We could say that as a woman, Ariadne is asleep. It was easy to see myself in her. All those sleeping years I'd identified with patriarchy. The myth forced me to go back and consider the ways I'd been a good little princess. It caused me to finally deal with the faces of daughterhood I'd identified in myself, to probe where and how I had lived them out, to understand what had motivated them, and to begin to break their patterns, not just by giving some intellectual assent in my head, but by living out the struggle each day. The myth does not tell us explicitly what evoked Ariadne's awakening. Perhaps she began to feel the confines of living in her father's palace, or to wonder if there was some reality beyond the realm of her father. But most certainly something inside her started to rouse and stir, for soon she would seize her moment and make a dramatic exit. During this time in her journey, a woman begins to receive wake-up calls. She begins to peel away the illusions and come to see and feel her entrapment in patriarchy. For me, the disenchantment had started with the strange slip of tongue when I had introduced myself as Father Sue, which led to uncovering my feminine wound. There was the moment I'd stood to sing Faith of Our Fathers in church and could not open my mouth, the tears and devastating feeling of betrayal that fell over me. And later, a thousand small bombs had gone off in my chest as I read and studied, forming my feminist critique. There had been all these things, and so many others. Theseus comes. Whatever sets off Ariadne's disenchantment is uncertain, but at her moment of ripening, a new figure appears in the story. The myth says a daring young hero from Athens arrived on the shores of Crete. "Every myth is psychologically symbolic," wrote Joseph Campbell. "Its narratives and images are to be read, therefore, not literally, but as metaphors. If Ariadne's father, the old king, is the consciousness of patriarchy operating inside her, then Theseus, who comes from a distant land across the water, suggests new ideas and attitudes. He represents Ariadne's freeing energy, or the way out of her sleep. In the story, Theseus is a daring adventurer and hero who has come to Crete to liberate Athens from the curse of the old king, King Minos. Theseus's mission is to slay the Minotaur, a half-man, half-bull monster that lives in a labyrinth beneath the palace. Because of an old debt, every 7 years King Minos requires Athens to send 7 youths to Crete, where they are placed in the labyrinth to feed the Minotaur. By killing the monster, Theseus will defy the old king and liberate Athens from the curse. When Ariadne sees Theseus, she falls in love and devises a way to convince him to take her away with him when he leaves Crete. Theseus, or the liberating energy in my own life, emerged in part the day I entered the drugstore and saw Anne on her knees before the laughing men. The scene tapped my defiance. That day my intention was consolidated. Theseus also came when I mustered the will to free myself from supporting patriarchy within the church and began to align myself with liberation theologies and ideals. Theseus came when I sat in the den and explained to Sandy that our marriage would have to be undone and redone, that I would be going away. Wherever there is deliverance and release in a woman's life from the oppression of patriarchal consciousness, there is Theseus. Often, like Ariadne, a woman cannot recognize or contact the heroic freeing energy in herself. Instead, she projects it outward, usually onto a man. Theseus may be a figure she literally falls in love with, someone who can shatter her identification with the old consciousness and help deliver her from it. For some women, especially younger women, Theseus may be a husband, the man who rescued her from the patriarchal father. For other women, Theseus may be projected onto some other man, a mentor, lover, counselor, father, someone who rescues her at some level from a patriarchal husband. Or Theseus may come when a woman takes a different job or adopts a dissident cause, or he may be projected onto a new group or a new place. Anything that carries an aura of insurgence, opportunity, even destiny, that brings new thoughts and attitudes and undermines her loyalty to the old king. The projection, as precarious and havoc-wreaking as it may sometimes be, becomes a force that acts to free her. When a woman projects her liberating energy outward, she is acting unconsciously. If she projects it onto a man, she may be unable to initiate real independent action apart from him. She will be dependent on Theseus, not on herself. She cannot see that Theseus embodies her own unconscious potential and desire for freedom and wholeness. The hard moment will come when she needs to withdraw the projection, break the spell it has over her, and own up to what she is doing. She will have to claim the qualities she saw in these external figures as possibilities in herself. She will need to take up her own autonomous life. The Feminine Labyrinth. During the first few weeks of looking at my life through the lens of this myth, I was trying to determine where, if at all, I presently was in the story. I'd already discovered my Ariadne little princess self. Theseus had already appeared. Now, as I explored the next portion of the story, I knew I'd found the experience I was beginning to undergo, the labyrinth. Underground, beneath the palace of King Minos, is the labyrinth Theseus must enter in order to kill the Minotaur. Besides the danger of being devoured by the Minotaur, the labyrinth is so dark, vast, and complex that no one who wanders into it can find a way back out. Ariadne offers to help Theseus return from the maze if he promises to marry her and take her with him when he leaves her father's kingdom. When Theseus agrees, she gives him a ball of thread and tells him to unwind it as he enters the labyrinth and then to follow it back out. In this way, Theseus is able to kill the Minotaur and return successfully. The labyrinth is a centerpiece in Ariadne's story as it was in the actual Minoan culture. In that ancient time,
The labyrinth was not the complicated prison of a monster, as it later became in patriarchy, but a symbol of the divine womb